Welcome, friends, to the 82nd episode of the Work Item Podcast. And today I'm talking to entrepreneur extraordinaire Craig Hewitt. Craig is the founder of the podcasting platform Castos, comes from generations of entrepreneurs, and his own journey builds on the experience and stamina of those that came before him. In this show, we chat about best practices for hiring developers for your bootstrap startup, finding the right approach to deliver hard news, and how to ensure that your relationships aren't hurt as you embark on the entrepreneurship treadmill. I hope you enjoy the show. This has been a very, very insightful conversation about a lot of topics around starting your own business, starting your own startup, and how to build a life around it. Enjoy the show. Hello, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Work Item Podcast. And today I'm talking to Craig Hewitt. Craig is a bootstrapper. He's the founder of Castos. He has been on numerous podcasts and he runs his own podcast like Rogue Startups. Craig, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to chatting today.
Very much so, because as I mentioned right before we started recording that this season is about entrepreneurs, folks that are starting their businesses, exploring the kind of the field of creating their own startup from scratch. And who better to talk to you than you, since you've started your own company from scratch. So maybe walk us through kind of your entrepreneur origins. What started it all?
Gosh, what started it all? It may be a bit trite, but I'd have to say, like, my parents, you know, I'm third or fourth generation kind of entrepreneur. My dad, his dad, I think his dad, all were kind of self-employed business owners. And I've just always had that, right? Like, I've definitely had corporate jobs, and I actually think that's really, really important to an entrepreneur being successful is like having the corporate experience to kind of pick and choose the bits that they like, but also kind of have the disdain for it, because like you have to have the why, right? And the why is not just like, I want to go to the beach with my kids this afternoon. The why is like, I did that thing and it sucked. I don't ever want to go back to that again. I think the corporate experience is good is important on the good and bad side. But I've had a couple of companies over kind of my work life, and Castos came around because I started my podcast, which you mentioned. It's called Rogue Startups, where I just chat about entrepreneurship a lot. And got a couple episodes in, and I was like, wow, like, this is a pain. Like, this is hard. This takes a lot of time. This is complicated. I don't really know what I'm doing. But I was like, man, I bet there's a bunch of other people who have the same problem. And so we started kind of a productized service around podcast editing and production. This is 10 years ago. Still have that business unit within Castos today. That kind of evolved and led to us acquiring a WordPress plugin called Seriously Simple Podcasting, which is how Castos got started as a hosting platform. And today, you know, we have kind of two arms of the business. One is our Castos Productions service, where we do done-for-you editing for about 60 different podcasts on a regular basis. And then we host a whole bunch of, tens of thousands of podcasts on the Castos platform. It's a ton of fun. It's definitely a journey and a wild ride, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
And so you mentioned starting in corporate is helpful to have that contrast. What was the breaking point for you? Like, what was kind of the moment where you're like, you know what? This is it. I can't do this.
Having kids, 100%. Yeah. So we have two kids. They're now 11 and 13, but my youngest was kind of just born, and it's interesting, man. I was making really good money. I was in sales. In the medical device world, making really, really good money, traveling a lot, away from the family a lot. We lived in New Orleans at the time. And the breaking point really was we had like a hurricane or a tropical storm coming or something. And like our street was flooding, like actively, like the water was moving up our street. And I had to go to work because I was like in the medical field. I had to go to the hospital because there was like a procedure I had to be a part of. And I had to leave my family in our house as like, it was flooding. And I was like, this is screwed up. Like, I just can't even believe that I'm doing this. But like, yeah. And so I was like, okay, that there just has to be a different way. I had been doing, what we called Podcast Motor, our kind of product as service for a while. But then I was like, okay, I got to start like laying the groundwork and make the plans to be able to exit my corporate job to be able to do this full time, save up a bunch of money, grow that thing so we can get some cash flow and make the move. But I think to your point, like you have to have that pivotal moment. You have to have that like straw that breaks the camel's back or otherwise you'll just flounder and think about doing it for a long time and never actually do it because it's a big thing to have to get over. And if you don't have that stimulus, then you probably won't.
Right. And especially because for a lot of people, it's the impetus in actually like changing things. It's like, you know, sometimes people are just like, yeah, it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, like I get a steady paycheck. You get some bonuses. You get some RSUs every once in a while. Yeah. And it's like, it's okay. And some people are just kind of okay just floating through it.
Yeah. And it's not wrong, right? Like a corporate job is 100% not wrong. And for most people, it is the right answer, actually, I think.
You also mentioned that you started the company from kind of your own set of problems that you've encountered as you were kind of building out your own podcast. And one of the common, I want to say like the tropes in kind of the entrepreneurship world is like, well, don't start from your own problem because you might be the only one with that problem, right? Like start from the market. How did you validate that that problem was actually something that the broader market had kind of the opportunity existed?
I don't know that either are entirely right or wrong. I think you know, listen to yourself and your own experiences and problems. I think that's really valuable. I think that you then need to say, am I representative of the market? Maybe to say, are there other people who can go buy this stuff? I think largely validation is a myth, though. You hear a lot of people talk about, oh, I read the mom test and I talked to 10 customers and I even got prepaid. And then I spent 6 months in the basement building my SaaS app and nobody bought it. But, you know, I think it's because we are talking to people with different intents when we're validating than when we're in the market and we have a thing to sell them. And that's probably why I'm so bullish on if you're starting as an entrepreneur, don't, you mentioned Rob Walling, like he has the stair-step approach. Like don't start with a SaaS application because I can tell you it's hard as crap. Like it's really hard. There's so many moving pieces to it. What you should start with is do some consulting. Have a productized service maybe as like the second step. You know, Rob talks about like have some kind of one-time sale product, like a WordPress plugin or a Shopify app. Or, you know, I think that is okay. But I really like get into the market and provide a service because you literally can do it in like an hour, right? Like you can set up Card as a single page and have a Stripe account and you can open a business in an hour, literally. Like we could do it in the midst of this podcast episode. And then you go on LinkedIn and say, I do this for this type of people to get this result, and you'll get customers. And then from there, you can say, okay, I really understand the problem space. I understand the types of customers. I understand where I could maybe fit in this. I see this gap in the market from a technology or a solution perspective, and I can fit in there. And so what I think you've done is just de-risked enormously that next step. And I think that's where people who fail, if you will, as entrepreneurs, is they try to skip three steps ahead. Maybe they raise some money, so that's even kind of more intense because like the expectation is so much higher. But I think if you take like I think about careers in like 10-year chunks, you know, is you have these 10 years you're going to be working on a thing. Take the first year or two and just learn the space, make some money in it as like trading dollars for hours. There's nothing wrong with that as long as that value is pretty high. Then you got the next 8 years to really build a solid business, scale, operationalize, get yourself out of the business. And I'm biased because that's what I did, but I think it's a pretty smart model.
I like the fact that you're calling out an actual practical, honestly, real business put in place, even if it's a service, because you hear from a lot of startup kind of founders, it's like, oh, you have to start with like a landing page. It's like, it's all fake, right? Like it's all smoke and mirrors and put a sign up, like a button, and the people will sign up and put their email. And then in a year, once you're ready, you'll actually like send them an email and launch things. But you're saying that maybe you should start with something real today, but small.
No, not maybe, definitely. Yeah, I can't imagine putting up the landing page, starting a waiting list, and then 6 months later, coming back to that waiting list and saying, hey, first of all, they don't remember you. Second of all, their problem is already solved or it doesn't exist anymore. And third, the market's changed in 6 months, especially these days, to where like the thing that was a problem that they signed up for probably isn't a problem anymore, or in the same way that you thought about it. Yeah, I don't think you can do that anymore.
I'm thinking as a customer myself, like if I'm looking to solve a problem and I go to a website and I see like, oh, cool, this is probably solving my problem. And I click on sign up and it's like, oh, put your email. Like, nope, that doesn't solve my problem. I'm going to go find something else then.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't have an incentive to wait.
No, The reality is like, especially if you're talking about software, like it's so easy, right? Like I'm not a developer. I'm a pretty unique solo non-technical founder, right? I don't code. But software is pretty easy. Like in the world of SaaS, like the product is the easiest part. Not to say that it's easy, but it's the easiest part. I mean, no code and things like Tailwind and Rails or whatever, like there's so many advantages there. What's really hard is getting customers profitably and on like a repeatable basis.
When you transitioned to entrepreneurship, how did you de-risk your, well, changeover and kind of career paths? Because when you're working in a corporate position or for another company, it doesn't need to be like a big corporation, you have the kind of steady paycheck. And especially for somebody that, you know, you have a family and kids, that's important. And you have to switch to now something that's like, I depend on my own paycheck. How was that? Like, what was the process of minimizing or reducing risk? Like, what if things fail on the other side?
I was really lucky and quite intentional. And I think you kind of need both. And just a lot of hard work, right? So it's those three things. Lucky in that podcasting was kind of taking off at this time. I got in at like a really good time and kind of rode not the previous wave, but the one before, not the one around COVID, but the one before. I also was making a lot of money at my day job. And so all the money from starting the editing service, we just kept in the bank. We didn't need to spend any of it. And we were saving from my day job income. But then I was working nights and weekends a lot to do sales calls and, you know, stepping out at lunch to do sales calls and staying up late to work on customer projects and managing the team and figuring out how to run payroll and all that kind of stuff. So like it was all three of those, you know, got fortunate the business kind of took off, but we were in the right place at the right time, right? But the business took off, didn't need the money because I had a day job still, which is super important. And then was working, you know, 15-hour days probably to put it all together.
How do you balance, I want to say, family relationships in that situation? Because one of kind of the story is, you know, you have to do nights and weekends, but if you have a family and you have kids and you have a spouse, how do you balance that?
Everybody has to be on board. And like if you have a 1 and 3 year old, they can't get on board, but your spouse, your partner has to get on board and know, hey, we're kind of going through the desert right now, but on the other side is this thing. And I'm going to be busy for the next 6 months and I'll be around as much as I can, but that's probably just Saturday and Sunday, you know, afternoons or whatever. And is that worth it to everybody? That's kind of the calculus. And my wife was super supportive. She saw what was happening with like our work-life balance at a corporate job, and there was no promise of it getting better. And so she was like, yeah, we got to do something. This seems reasonable. Like that business is growing. We have money in the bank. We're saving. You know, this is a fair bet. And that's really what it comes down to is like, how can you know and kind of manage that risk?
And so when you were first thinking about starting your own company, you were doing it at the same time kind of, or in your own time after work. What was the point when you realized, okay, this is actually viable. I can do this. Was there like that first dollar moment? It's like somebody paid for this. I can do this.
Kind of. Yeah. I don't remember the exact details, but at one point I put a date on the calendar and I had an app on my phone that was counting down the days to that date. And every morning it would pop up and say, you have 362 days to, you know, what, April 15th or whatever it is. And so like we were that conservative, like it was a year out where the business was making $5,000 a month, but we just wanted to reinvest that into marketing and team and growth and all that. And then I just, I had this date on the calendar where the business would grow. We would save money from like the day job and we would plan kind of our personal exit. So we had like sold our house ahead of time and started renting and all this stuff to where when it was over, we were, you know, we were ready to transition.
So it's not an instant, you know, it's like, oh, I started my, you know, I coded up the solution. Now I can quit my job. Like there was that point that like you actually need to make sure that that solution works.
Yeah. For more than like one customer or 1 month or something. Yeah.
When you got into the podcast space and you said like the podcast space was taking off, but there's also a lot of other podcast players out there, as we know, like today. Today, granted, the situation is a little bit different, but you have like Anchor, which is on Spotify. You have a whole bunch of services that kind of were acquired either by bigger conglomerates or companies and services that are still independent. How did you justify it to yourself? It's like, oh, this is actually something that I want to continue investing in, and like the bubble is not going to pop, if you will.
I think that that last part was really important when we first got started. You know, podcasting, I think today is very mature. I expect it to be around for a long time. Like it's not going anywhere. It's an established medium. I didn't always feel like that. But today, like I feel really good about it, but that was always like on my radar. Like, do we have, you know, there's all sorts of different types of risks in the company. Like, integration risk or platform risk, we have kind of like channel risk. Like, is this channel just going to go away? I don't think so. What we saw is quite different than today, that like most of the competitors out there to us at Castos didn't exist. When we started, it was Libsyn and Blueberry and Simplecast and SoundCloud. And three of those are terrible. Right? Like they're not good products. And so we looked at that and we were like, we can 100% do better than these guys. And that was the thesis, was we can build a better product. And what we did with acquiring the WordPress plugin was we acquired a distribution channel. So the WordPress plugin had 15,000 active installs. And we kind of said, cool, if we acquire this, can we sell some fraction of those onto our hosting plan? And that's what we did.
So basically the plugin was the gateway to your bigger product that had this more comprehensive offering for podcasters.
Exactly. Yep.
You mentioned that you are a non-technical founder, which again, I want to emphasize the fact that this is seems like to myself an atypical format for somebody to kind of start a company, because you hear a lot of stories from folks that say, oh, you know, yeah, I was the one that coded my first prototype and then I built the app and I published the app and then started getting customers. How did you overcome that challenge yourself? Like, if you are not the one writing the code for it, how do you do it?
Well, we hired really good people, I think, is the short answer. And even how you do that is really challenging. I had failed products, like smaller products before in the podcasting space. And they failed largely because like they were bad. They were bad products. And you know, I didn't know how to hire developers. I didn't know how to manage developers. I didn't know how to specify, like take what's in my head from a product idea perspective and put it into a format that they can understand and implement. That's probably the hardest part, is like as a marketer and like the product or the subject matter expert of podcasting, I had all the ideas and I had the roadmap and I knew where we were going. The biggest stress we had, we got really lucky with hiring our first developer. It's amazing. But what was the challenge was I would say, hey, please go build this thing. And he would go build the thing. And it was like different, you know, he built something 20 degrees different than what I wanted. I was like, man, like, okay, that's, and it would come, he'd be like, okay, we're getting ready to deploy this thing. And be like, you know, no, it's like, this is wrong. Can you change that to that? And there was quite a bit of friction. And I had to learn, we had to hire a product designer who's still with us today. He's absolutely amazing. But that was the solution for me, is like, hire really, really good people, both on the development side and on the product side, so that I literally can say, I want to make this thing. And then they go put it together and I get feedback and we iterate like that. And then it's done. But that's by far the hardest part for a single non-technical founder is to learn how to communicate what's in your brain into a format that they can be successful with.
What are your biggest takeaways or lessons learned when hiring folks? You mentioned that you've kind of failed at hiring folks, the right folks from the beginning. If you look back on it, thinking like, well, here's the things that I would do differently, what would those be?
I think the easy one is like referrals from other people is the cheat code. And that's how we've hired most of our people. It only scales kind of so far, but if you can get it, like hands down, that's the way to go. You know, from there, I think another place people fail is trying to be cheap. And I definitely have done that. And we've done it successfully some. I live in the US, we're an American company. About half our team is overseas because they make good money for where they live, but it's really cheap for us. I think trying to do that too much, and if you're inexperienced and if you don't have strong leadership in the company or within like the product or engineering division, is tough, just because not because they're not good developers or stuff, but there's like this cultural disconnect a lot of times with like how I communicate and how they interpret that, and even in some places, like their cultural kind of acceptance of feedback or questions, or and anybody who's kind of done this has seen this, but you just can't hire someone in a place like Serbia or India or the Philippines or anywhere really outside the US and expect them to get you as if you're in the US as an American or a Canadian, and vice versa, right? Like the way that a person in India would communicate with me would seem different largely. And so we all have to take that into account as we're communicating. And so kind of offshoring and the kind of arbitrage opportunity there is very real and really great, but really hard to pull off entirely. And so our model today, I really, really like, which is where we have like a lead typically here that kind of owns that role. And then we do have folks overseas who that person manages. And I really like that model because you get a bit of both. So you're not entirely optimizing for the geo arbitrage. But as a single founder, I can't actively manage a dozen people. I can actively manage four or five. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do.
In the entrepreneurial startup landscape, there's always kind of that a chasm between solo founders that do things themselves and then founders that hire folks. For you personally, was hiring kind of just a way to fill the kind of the technical gap, if you will? Or was it more like, I want to scale my business and I just will not be able to do this by myself. I need people.
Yeah, definitely the latter. I like to have a team. I like to have people. I can't imagine, you know, this solopreneur movement. Like nothing sounds worse in the world to me than just waking up and staring at my computer for 8 hours a day and not having people to bounce energy off of and things like that. Like that just sounds so horrible. Like what my ideal state is a team of, you know, however many people. We're 9 people now. Like that's a really great size. A group of people, we can depend on each other. We can cover each other's backs. I'm going to be on vacation in 2 weeks for 10 days. Like they're good. They got it. I can't imagine a business where I'm just responsible for everything. I can't ever go on vacation. I have alerts on my phone all the time. And like, that's not a business. That's a job. So I think if anything, I over index on that, because from a personality standpoint, I just really like it. So kind of whenever we have extra money in the company, I'm like, who can we hire? Like I want more people, because I do think, and I think this is a bit wrong, but I do think that more people, all things considered, is better. You know, it's more opportunity to wow customers. But I think the trap, like if I'm really honest, is you have to be quite sure that investment is going to be ROI positive. And that's really hard, because you don't know. You don't know until you hire that person. And there's not an elegant way to say, I thought this would be ROI positive, but we're 8 months in and it's not. Sorry, And that's the hard thing.
How do you build the skills to be able to do that? Or I guess like maybe in your case, do you think that your background in sales kind of helped you be a little bit more like comfortable with those conversations?
It's just always super hard. It's always so hard. I was advising a fellow founder yesterday actually on this. He was having to let someone go for the first time, and it's hard. You're going to be shaking. Literally, you're not going to sleep. You know, the few nights before, you know, it's going to happen. You're going to feel like shit. They're going to feel like shit. You're going to question yourself. I think the reality is, if like you're at heart a good human and you treat the person with respect and you support them however you can, and that can take a lot of different forms, then you're doing an okay thing. And the thing is that I think a lot of us don't realize is you're actually doing the best thing for everyone else still on the team and the company. And that's not to be discounted, because like everyone always says like, oh, we're a family. Like, you're not a family, you're a company. And a company is here to deliver value to you as a founder and to your employees in the form of having a job and to your shareholders, whether that's just you or you have investors. It's not to just have a cool place to work. Like, I think that's part of it, but that's part of it in service of delivering value. Like, having cool company culture just to have a ping pong table in the break room is not right. You know, it is so you can recruit the best people to come to work there and love working there so that they can then operate at a high level. That's what it's all about.
Like, I think Netflix is the one that coined the analogy. Like, we're not a family, we're a high performing team, like a sports team, basically. Like, on a sports team, everyone needs to do their job for the team to win. No hard feelings. If you're underperforming, you're not going to be on the team anymore. It's simple as that.
Yeah. And I think I am definitely guilty of this. So I kind of know the optimal state and like where this should be. But it's hard in reality, because you have worked with this person for years and they're a great person. It just so happens they're kind of in the wrong seat. And part of that is always your fault as a manager. It's not necessarily or always their fault. At the end of the day, you run the company.
Absolutely. And so when you hire people, or when you hire people for your company, what is kind of that bar for assessing that they're going to be a good fit? Like, do you wait 60 days, 90 days? What's your threshold of saying like, all right, yeah, they're a fit?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. I think like to take like a half a step back from that, like the decision to hire is like, can this person be ROI positive in a period of time that I can define? 3 months, 6 months, something like that. Like, after you get after, like, we just have to have a developer because we're a SaaS company. We have to have a customer support person because we have customers. Like, you fill all those buckets. When you start getting to elective hires, then it's like, can this person be ROI positive in some period of time? And typically, that's like less than 6 months. So once you've decided that, you hire. I really like this framework of starting with like a 90-day review in mind, and then I write the job title reflecting that. So in 90 days, you will have done this and you will be at this point and you'll be contributing in this way. Like, that's really healthy, because then the person that you're hiring knows where the goal line is, right? To continue the sports analogy. Like, I think the worst thing we can do as managers is not be really clear on what success looks like. And if we are, then someone comes in, they're like, cool, I got to rock and roll in this way, in this way, and in this way. And if I do, then I'm successful. So that's great. So like, I think you as a founder or manager have to define what that is, write the job title to reflect that. And then the right person should kind of be attracted to that. But we have really, really clear and honest discussions in the first couple of weeks. We have definitely hired people where a weekend we let them go because it was just obvious they weren't a good fit. I think that comes in at companies our size, most of the time where they used to work at Oracle or something, and they're just used to a 5,000 person company, and you come in and you're like, hey, we're a team of eight. Here you go. Here's your laptop. Figure it out. They're going to go, whoa, like I need more than that. And that's not right or wrong. That's just them. The times where we've had bad, I'll say, culture fits from a work perspective is when somebody just needs a big company and we're not, and we didn't appreciate that early. So we've made that mistake. We won't do that again. I think that after that 2 week or 30 day period, you should know, like, cool, I got a gem. This is a perfect kind of fit. And then from there, like it isn't necessarily like the person, but the opportunity that can fail. So like, we just don't need this role. Like, this role isn't delivering value to the company. And then that's a different conversation. But I don't think you picked the wrong person. You kind of made the wrong bet on the role.
And like you said, the focus is on being ROI positive, which is a good framework to basically see, is this person actually providing value to the team and the company at a specific point in time when there is a specific need for a role or need for a specific responsibility? The thing that you also called out was around communicating the vision to the developers that you hire. And to me, I think it comes down to the analogy of like the missionaries versus mercenaries. Like, you pay somebody and they're like, yep, I'm going to get the job done. You asked me to like write you up a login page. I'm going to write you up a login page. There you go. Versus somebody that actually believes in the fact that like, yeah, I want to help this company grow and become the best it can possibly be. How do you communicate that vision and get people bought in into it to say that, yeah, I want to do this in a long run?
I think you need a bit of both. I don't believe all the way one way or the other is right. I think you need a bit of both. There's some personality assessments that go into this that I think are really important. We do them with our team because the fact is you need mercenaries and you need missionaries on the team, because if you're just missionaries, fucking nothing ever is going to get done, right? But if you're just mercenaries, then you're going to have a whole bunch of people making login pages and you're not going to have a concise, holistic product that really kind of speaks to the audience. And so we very much feel like we need both within our company. And as we were making hiring decisions, we kind of look at these personality assessments and say, where is the gap? Not from a functional perspective, but from a personality type perspective. It's from the Table Group. Gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but if you just look up the Table Group personality assessment, it'll pop up. It's really great.
So it allows you to, before you essentially hire them, get an understanding of like where they kind of stand.
Yeah, you could do that. I think you also want to do that with your existing team to know where the gaps are.
How do you make sure that folks on the team understand the vision, right? So you as a founder, when you were starting Castos, you probably have an idea of like, here's a North Star. I want that to get here. And when you hire folks from the outside, right, like they come in with their own understanding of what the project is, what the software should be, what the whole bunch of kind of constraints that they created themselves. How do you make sure that everybody's on the same page with what you as the founder see as a North Star for the company?
I often think this is a like ill-used term, but I think that's where being a leader really comes in. Like, you have to show up every day and live the mission, vision, and values that you say. I mean, we have them all on our website, but I am and should be an embodiment of those, and everyone else should be too. Otherwise, it's just garbage and rhetoric and you being a faker, right? But like, if I say these are the values and I live the values and our development team builds products around those values and our support team supports our customers in those values and our marketing team, you know, displays our message, you know, that are aligned with those values, then we're winning and that's right. And if anybody is missing there, that's where like bad culture fit comes in. Largely though, like the founder or the manager isn't living those values to attract the right kind of people.
But in your case, it's effectively leading by example. Like, you have to exemplify the values and you have to be communicating about the North Star. So it kind of team internalizes over time rather than just kind of a, hey, we just hired you. Read this doc. Here's our vision. Good luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the last questions that I always ask folks in this podcast, and it's probably the most interesting one, is if you would think of an unconventional piece of advice for somebody that wants to become an entrepreneur, for somebody that wants to follow in kind of your journey, what would that advice be from you? Somebody that has no context of entrepreneurship, they are just assessing this as a viable path for them.
Work for free. And by that, I mean, if you are not in the space that you want to ultimately be in, you probably can't charge for a product or service in that space. But what you definitely can do is learn the skills, and then do it for free as a way to prove and get, you know, context and reputation, rapport in the industry, and then use that as a selling mechanism. And that's how we got started. Is I had a podcast. I did a really terrible but okay enough job at producing my podcast. And to launch our service, I just approached a few of my friends. I was like, hey, can I just do this for you for free? And if you like it, you can pay me. It's going to be $300 a month or whatever it was at the time. And that was a way for me to kind of enter the space, have a no risk offer for them. Because the worst thing that could happen is I do a bad job and they have to do it anyhow. The best thing is they get an episode for free. The best for me is that leads to a customer. But I think this is really underutilized as an approach, because we all have this thing of like, well, that just doesn't work at scale. But of course it doesn't work at scale. Like, all you want is your first two customers or a case study to then go sell those, your first real customer. So that's the trick I like, is just suck it up for a while, right? And get that bit of sales enablement that you're looking for.
And that's also a way to gain the experience in the field, especially if you're breaking into something where you don't really fully understand the picture, which I'm guessing for a lot of folks that is the case. You're coming into podcasting, or maybe you're going into like video editing or whatever that might be. You probably don't know everything about that field just yet. Like, why not get that experience, try things out, and then see what the rough edges are yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't know the space. Nobody knows you. This is the fastest way to get customers.
I love it. That's a fantastic unconventional advice to wrap this off on. Craig, folks can find you on your website. And they, of course, can go to castos.com to try out Castos. What other channels should they follow you on?
Yeah, gosh. So my website, craighewitt.me, kind of has everything that I do. I have a podcast, as you mentioned, called Rogue Startups, where I talk about entrepreneurship. We're doing a whole series on LinkedIn right now as kind of a great sales and kind of growth channel. And then I'm definitely active on LinkedIn. You can look me up there.
Excellent. And we'll make sure to include the links in the show notes so folks can just click there. You don't need to listen to us talk about this and go and sell it. Just click the links. Craig, thank you so much for being part of the show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.